Reach and close the doors. We tried to start on time as much as possible. Please close the back door. Please close the back door. Please close the back door. Thank you. Good afternoon. Good to see you. Are you ready to start? Good. Open the House Interim Committee on Human Services on today, January 14th, 2010. Thank you all for coming. We're going to change the agenda somewhat. We will have the first public hearing on House Bill 3623, and then we'll have a public hearing on House Bill 3618. Thank you all for coming. It's always delightful to see this room filled. If we'd known so many people were coming, we would have had an overflow room. But do thank you all for being here. So, is that all we need to do before we open up? We open up the public hearing on House Bill 3623. Representative Barton, Representative Deputy Bickford. Hi.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brent Barton. I represent House District 51. Thank you for having us here today. I'm unsurprised to see that you run a tight ship. And, thank you. Members of the committee, human trafficking is really nothing less than one of the great moral issues of our time. It is the prevalence of this, I think Officer Bickford will speak to this more, is literally two orders of magnitude greater than I think most of us realize. Most of us, I think of human trafficking and sexual slavery as a foreign issue. But the extent to which it surrounds us, even us here in this great state, is shocking and it is terrible. And this legislation is one of but a first step in a series of steps that hopefully can make government at every level, municipal, county, state, and federal level, more effective and indeed smarter on this issue. Generally speaking, I would say the discourse behind this represents an attempt to shift the way that government engages the issue of human trafficking from a public safety issue where the question asked is, for what do we prosecute the victim, to more of a human services question. How can we get this victim the treatment she usually, sometimes he needs to transition and really resurrect their lives. And so this bill is, I hope, by the first of but a series of steps. I would also like to recognize Senator Wyden. Actually, the New York Times recently wrote an article that Senator Wyden's legislation that he sponsored with Chuck Schumer, that parallels this bill. And also Commissioner Salzman in the city of Portland and Multnomah County Commissioner Diane McKeel, from whom you will hear later. And Commissioner McKeel in particular has been, I would say, the chief agitator amongst elected officials anyway in this state for this issue. So I very much appreciate your time and your attention, and I look forward to working with this committee and our colleagues, not just on this bill, but also in subsequent steps in the future.
Thank you for bringing the bill to our committee. Thank you very much, Representative Barton. Yes.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Keith Bickford. I'm a deputy for Multnomah County Sheriff's Office and also the director of the State of Oregon Human Trafficking Task Force. I'm just coming for just to talk to you a little bit about the issues I'm running into, and I wrote some things down I'd just like to share with you very quickly, and then I'll get out of your way. The state of Oregon is tailor-made for both domestic, which is underage sex trafficking, and international foreign-born trafficking. The I-5 corridor, I-84, Columbia and Willamette Rivers, sex industry, and a large farming community create the perfect world for traffickers and their victims. Because of the high number of domestic and international victims, I've had to break the Oregon Human Trafficking Task Force into four different groups. Currently, Oregon is the only state that has had to do that because of the amount of both the traffickers and victims that we have. The major problems I'm working on right now would be the shelter for the underage sex trafficking victims and start educating our junior high and high schools because of the amount of recruiting that's happening there regarding the domestic trafficking. And then also, my biggest goal, I guess, for international is trying to find the victims themselves. They're very scared. They're the perfect victim, so to speak, because they don't speak the language. They don't usually know where they are. They don't know laws. They don't know that they have rights here, even though they are here illegally. It's my, I think, my responsibility to go out there and show them that I will take care of them, help them, get them to interview and talk to me about what had happened, what happens, and then hopefully share some other victims' stories with me, and I can, you know, try to help them out as well. With the task forces, I do try to get law enforcement to work better together, along with victim services as well.
Thank you so much. Generally, I would wait until all the speakers have had a chance to speak, but since these two gentlemen will be leaving the speaker's podium, I will open it up to questions. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome. And I just, even though this sounds a little odd, I'm really glad this is happening. I'm glad this bill has been brought forward. Thank you, Representative. Keith has been active from the beginning, and I met with Commissioner McKeel earlier this year, too. And so we did this three sessions ago, or 2007, I guess. Either five or seven, doesn't matter. Some years ago, we did Senate Bill 578, and it ended up in a task force, et cetera, and that's where I met him. He is, you're completely doing this now. Your total assignment is this issue.
Yes, ma'am, it is.
Okay, thanks. And just a test to the importance of this issue. And just as a side note, I just wanted to touch on how important it is. It's easy to ignore it. And when I was in Saskatchewan this year, in Regina for a conference on economic issues and ocean energy. I met somebody there who said they're one of the top cities in Regina in Canada for trafficking. And I thought, in the middle of the prairie? And it is. It's true. And so anyway, this is a very important issue. It's, I think, easily solvable with some money and some will, and you know, and we can't ignore it. We can't ignore it because, I mean, as you'll hear probably throughout this testifying or testimony today, the recruitment is just insidious. How this is happening? It's not seedy old men on the street corner. It's kids. It's young girls themselves recruiting out of their own schools, and it's very insidious. This is what's happening in Europe. It has happened all over Asia. And it's easy to say, like you said, it's a foreign issue, but it's not. It's right here in our own backyard. So thanks for indulging me. I just hope that we keep this on the front burner and do something.
Absolutely, Representative. Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen. And I know
Chair,
we have
one quick question.
Sure.
And this, what do you expect to get out of this? I mean, what is this? What is the outcome as a result of the bill?
I mean, Madam Chair and Representative Maher.
I'm not supporting the concept. It is this. I want to hear from your own words. What do you expect to accomplish?
Madam Chair and Representative Maher, thank you for the question. So I'm understanding your question to be referring specifically to this particular piece of legislation, which I believe Representative Smith will delve into in more detail. But I would say, in general, again, this is the first step. Because of the fiscal constraints, I would say that our primary objective from this legislation and sort of the first wave is to raise awareness of this issue.
Okay, so it's an issue. Then, Madam Chair, follow-up. Why is it only limited to OLCC?
Madam Chair and Representative Maher, a very good question. The reason why it was limited to OLCC, it was because, unsurprisingly, we wanted to have no fiscal impact because of the uncertainty of the budget situation in the upcoming February session. OLCC has a series of licensees that, and they frequently correspond. They basically send out mailers periodically to all their licensees such that we could dovetail one with those mailings with no additional fiscal cost. That was the primary motivator. The secondary motivator is, simply put, that it was potentially visible. This is a good place potentially to raise awareness from with the sector or sectors of the population who might not necessarily go into the post office or other traditional fora in which we, which government attempts to engage the public.
Thank you. One real quick. And then last question is it your intent that that OLCC would have under rulemaking authority be able to object to a document for distribution that was clearly offensive? I mean, it's factually accurate. It meets some of these criteria, but is you look at it and you go, ooh, that's not what I want.
Madam Chair and Representative Maurer, I have to admit, I don't fully understand the question. I'm happy to engage with you later.
You're talking about human trafficking.
Correct.
And clearly you could have pornography that is factually accurate, that's about human trafficking, that might not be appropriate for distribution through the state.
Madam Chair and Representative Maurer, I assure you that it is not, certainly not my intent to in any way offend people. I would say we have been engaged with the OLCC. They've been very good partners in this process. And I think we have a rough consensus on what will go out there. I certainly do not foresee any pornography being sent out as a result.
I just wanted to know your intent.
No.
And
okay.
So thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Representative Smith, it sounds like you'd like to answer that question.
I will answer many of Representative Maurer questions.
Thank you so much. Any further questions of these first two gentlemen? Thank you very much. Did I see? Okay. Thank you very much for coming. Appreciate all the work you've done. Thank you. Representative Smith and Commissioner, County Commissioner McKeel, welcome to the legislature.
Thank you.
It's wonderful
Thank
to
you.
See
Glad
you.
Glad to be here. Thank you. And she's my
constituent.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jefferson Smith. I represent District 47 in the Oregon House. I will offer a bit about how and why I got involved, a bit more about what the bill will do, and in anticipated answer to legitimate questions of Representative Maurer, what we hope the bill will do. First, and not part of my prepared words, I wanted to say something that occurred to me is I saw many of the people I didn't realize were going to be coming to the meeting today and appreciate that they came to the hearing. When I first heard about this, I assumed that human trafficking was an issue that was rare, small, and not particularly egregious, or at least not to the degree it was communicated in movies. Since being engaged in some conversations around this, including a human trafficking conference in a very recent weekend, I realized it is more egregious and more common and bigger. To give you just two facts, the average age in international human slavery-based prostitution is 12. The industry, and it is an industry, not a bad habit on occasion, is at least a $40 billion a year industry. This is a global challenge. Why did I start paying attention? Not merely because of those facts. I first want to give a nod to Commissioner McKeel, who brought the issue to the attention of both me and Representative Barton. And I want to acknowledge Representative Barton, who's showing real leadership on this. It was also communicated to me the impact this has on my district, and my district is not unique. There are others similar, where we suffer from unemployment, high school dropout rates that are higher than we would like, where young people and women in particular have become caught in vicious cycles of criminal activity. It is one thing if that criminal activity is selling drugs. Is it another when those drugs are provided to yield the addictive incentive to promote, induce global, international human slavery-based prostitution? This is a big deal. I would offer that one similarity of why I think that Representative Barton's answer to your question in terms of raising awareness is important is I would draw an analogy, and this is not my analogy, to domestic violence some years ago, which is still a challenge, but some years ago an even bigger one related to the fact that nobody talked about it. And nobody investigated it. And people didn't know where to find help. So what will the bill do? The bill will allow a nonprofit organization to provide the OLCC with stickers about the size of a dollar bill or other materials that list the National Human Trafficking Hotline and or have information about human trafficking, free of any charge to the state. The Polaris Project is a Washington, D.C. nonprofit dedicated to combating human trafficking. and it has committed to providing those materials, and thank you again to Leadership Listed, with no cost to the state of Oregon. The hotline will help assess the situation, refer or conference them directly to shelters and service centers. The hotline is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, accessible to 150 languages. This was relevant to me because 65 languages are spoken in David Douglas High School District in my district. Yeah, I hear the wow. Go Scots. The OLCC in their annual mailing to all licensees will include the sticker and a cover letter designed to educate establishment owners of the issue and encourage them to post the materials in a conspicuous place. The sticker language says report human trafficking by calling the number. Human trafficking and enforced prostitution is a form of slavery practiced around the world and here in Oregon with two websites. That will be the sticker. It won't have images. It will not be particularly provocative, but it hopes to be informative. The bill, we hope, will be helpful in four ways, which we might view as concentric circles. Since a similar law was passed in Texas, that one a little more stringent than ours, there it required, here it is merely permissive. If there are committee members who want to take it further, my guess is the advocates on the issue would not be disappointed if you decided to do so. Ours is permissive. Since Texas passed a similar law, calls to the hotline have risen by about 200 calls per month. Not all of those from Texas. That is not all causal. But nonetheless, 200 helps. It's about 650 calls per month total, and that's with only one state so far. First, in the first little circle, the bill will help facilitate direct relief. 2-5% of all those calls are direct requests for help. That could mean avoiding or rescuing several human slaves. I would offer that saving one will be a bigger accomplishment than I offer during my service here. Second, in the second concentric circle, 25-30% of all calls are tips of suspicious behavior to help avoid or rescue other instances of trafficking. Third, another bulk of calls are from agencies requesting information about how to provide support related to the challenge earlier that right now people who are supposed to know stuff and represent districts, and I speak only of myself, knew far too little about this issue globally and even in my own district. My guess is I am not alone. And fourth, and related to that, is to raise awareness. The challenge of domestic violence decades ago is still in the memory of many, still in the memory of what happens even today. The challenge of people being underinformed about that is one that we needed to and need to on this resolve and work towards its resolution. One of the biggest challenges we face is the secrecy and danger of criminal trafficking circles. So I want to say thank you in response to one other question, why the OLCC, Representative Maurer. I think for us, one, in terms of the specifics of the bill, because we have the precedent in Texas. I think that around a table we might craft lots of potential bills. Some we might even come up with some that didn't cost much money. Some I can already think of that I still think would be good ideas. The nice thing about OLCC, it has pros and cons, but one nice thing, it is one-stop shopping for lots of establishments in our state, and the precedent in Texas is helpful. So we can answer other questions, and happy to, and also want to hear from Commissioner McKeel. So let me just say thank you. We recognize it's a smaller bill about a bigger thing, and thank you for your help on the smaller bill and for your attention to the bigger thing.
Thank you, Representative. Commissioner McKeel.
Thank you, Chair and Committee. I'm Diane McKeel, Multnomah County Commissioner, and I thank you for being here today and talking with you. I've received some nice comments of recognition today, but my real recognition goes to Deputy Keith Bickford. He's the one that I learned about this issue from in a presentation that he made. And so I just want to acknowledge that. It was so disturbing that I said, we have to do something. So anyway, I want to recognize Keith. And I want to begin by thanking Representative Barton for bringing this bill forward and Representative Smith for tirelessly advocating for it. The willingness of both of you to take this difficult issue on has been incredible, and I truly appreciate it. The problem of human trafficking is one that is rarely in the headlines, and it is mostly misunderstood in the United States. Passage of this bill could be a great step forward towards changing that. There is much work to be done that, to address this dangerous problem that exists across the state, and the passage of House Bill 3623 would be a significant part of doing so. There are various actions that are being taken across the state in an effort to increase awareness of this issue among the public, treat those who are being victimized, and punish those who are forced to engage in commercial sex or forced labor. In conjunction with the Oregon Travel Information Council, there will soon be posters with the human trafficking hotline and other information on human trafficking posted at 13 heavily used rest areas across the state. 7 of those rest areas are located along the busy I-5 corridor that is a primary way of passage for traffickers on the West Coast. These conspicuous postings will increase the likelihood that victims and other travelers will call the hotline, whether they are a victim of trafficking or think they might know someone who is. We are also working with the Caldera Arts film students to develop public service announcements around the issue, and Comcast has agreed to air them on cable free of charge. We hope these will educate the public on this underreported issue. It is important that we make it impossible for the public to continue to ignore it. After meeting with Senator Wyden's office last summer and bringing this issue to his attention, he has instantly become one of the greatest advocates for the elimination of trafficking in our state and in our nation. He has introduced Senate Bill 2925, which would provide block grants to states and local governments to provide funding for arrest and prosecution of pimps and traffickers, as well as the creation of victim safe houses, complete with mental and physical health programs and treatments across the nation. If passed, it could be the beginning of the end for trafficking as one of the most low-risk and high-reward crimes in our nation. Finally, in Multnomah County, we are working on the establishment of a school designed to reduce the number of those who purchase sex. Basic economics shows that where there is demand, there will be supply. Unfortunately, there is great demand for the purchase of sex in our state. By creating a diversion program as an alternative to the simple fine that those who are caught buying sex currently receive, we can begin to reduce demand. We hope to begin to educate Johns on the consequences of their actions and reduce the likelihood for recidivism of these crimes. That said, none of these actions or programs that I have mentioned have yet to be implemented or gained final approval. Here in the Oregon Legislature, you have the opportunity to be the first in that process. Human trafficking is a problem that's been allowed to go along unnoticed for far too long, and one that we must work to end as soon as possible. By showing that Oregon is willing to make a commitment to end this injustice, we can be an example to the rest of the United States. This bill has the potential to be a first step in a much broader movement to end the trafficking of humans. I urge you all to support it, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. Colleagues, I want to point out this is a very small step, I think has been acknowledged by several people, and a very huge issue. I don't want to, the conversation, we obviously have a lot of people here, we have a lot of bills we're going to be hearing today. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to give a whole lot of time to this issue. I would like to invite people to come back at a later time to give us a more in-depth view of this issue, give us more information. But I'd like us to keep our questions and our comments and our concerns just on this one bill. So if there are any quick questions, I would actually like to move along. Any?
I do have one question.
Yes, Representative Debra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this follows up on Representative Maurer's question about
why just locating these in the OLCC in terms of the bill? And has there been thought about other venues where, you know, potential victims or people who are familiar or know of victims would be prone to frequent?
Yes. And I think the Polaris Project is the national trafficking entity. And when we met with them in Washington, D.C., we asked them, what's a good first step? Because I think you all can see there's so much that needs to be done around this issue. This was their suggestion of a good first step. They have models of it in other states. They are the human trafficking hotline. As Representative Smith said, they receive the phone calls. They then bring them back to the jurisdiction where they belong. So that, again, is why there's no cost to this bill. And so that was the suggestion of experts. We certainly have, as I mentioned, we're working with Caldera art students to do public service announcement. They will be at rest areas along the freeways. We are certainly looking. We met with the FBI. They gave us some great suggestions of where to put other. So we're always looking for the venues that we consider this again a first step, and we're looking for the other venues as to where these would be very effective as well.
Okay, we're going to move along because we have a very full agenda, and we can have another public hearing if the committee feels like we need that, or if the public feels like they need more time to give testimony. We do have some written testimony from Stacy Bolivia. Is she here? Okay, it's written. Are you okay? We're not going to be able to hear you today. Appreciate your written testimony. We can provide that for the public also. Please put it. And I also have a whole file of material on human trafficking, and I can make that available to you. I can send it to you by email or however you'd like it. This is a huge issue. This committee will be dealing more with this issue, but this is a very small piece of it that we're dealing with in this today and in February session. Quick.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to amplify the answer with one small point, I actually want to say that I think that Polaris's choice of the OLCC was actually a relatively really smart one, because there's no other state agency you can think of that has access to that many distribution channels, right? If we try to do it at rest stops on the highways, if we try to do it in schools, the number of those things added up, if we went one by one, is nearly as many as the number of places we sell liquor. So I think that it was actually pretty smart, and thank you so much for the time you've already spent.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you
very much. We'll be hearing more from you later, I'm sure. Thank you so much. Okay, we're closing the public hearing on House Bill 3623. And we're opening up a public hearing on House Bill 3618. Sandy, read us that bill, if you will. I've got it right here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3618 was introduced at the request of Representative Dembro. It's modifying the definition of home care worker for the purpose of providing workers' compensation to certain individuals who receive compensation from the Department of Human Services, area agencies, or other public agencies. It's also requiring the department, the area agencies, and other public agencies to collect names of and other information pertaining to those individuals before October 1, 2010. The bill does some other things, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is some work that a group of folks, stakeholders, have done up to this point in regards to Senate Bill 702 from 2009.
Thank you very much. Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll be joined by Bob Jundeff here for this first panel.
All right. Welcome, Bob.
Chair Tomei, Honorable Human Services colleagues, I'm Michael Dembro. I'm the state representative for House District 45, Northeast Portland, Maywood Park, and Park Rose. And I'm pleased to bring you House Bill 3618 today. House Bill 3618 addresses a population and a need that you've heard about over the last couple of interim meetings of this committee. Those who use and those who provide home care and personal support services here in Oregon. Most of you are very much aware of Oregon's successful system of home and community care for seniors and persons with physical and developmental disabilities and mental health. These programs provide crucial state support to individuals, allowing them to stay out of institutions, live at home or in small group settings, remain active members of their communities, and in many cases, active workers, maintaining their independence, their autonomy, their dignity, their self-determination. Speaking personally, one of the real benefits, pleasures really, of serving in the legislature and on this committee in particular has been getting to know about these programs and the good that they're doing and the workers who provide these services. But I've also gotten to know about the inadequacies and inequities that are in the system as well. As is the case, I think, everywhere in the country, home and community care is very much a work in progress. For various reasons, which I can't say I fully understand yet, we have a bifurcated system in the human services world with seniors and individuals with physical disabilities often treated one way and individuals with developmental disabilities or mental illness treated another way. And I know there's a lot of history here, and I'm learning to the best of my ability. But this bill addresses one manifestation of this bifurcation. It seeks to bring workers who provide home care and personal support services to the latter population, that is, persons with developmental disabilities, mental health, to bring this latter population under the Oregon Home Care Commission program. You'll recall at our October 1st meeting, we heard from Cheryl Sanders Miller, the executive director of the commission, about the excellent work being done under the Home Care Commission. The commission, just to remind you, was created in the year 2000 when voters passed Ballot Measure 99, which amended the Oregon Constitution. The ballot measure stated that the Home Care Commission, quote, shall ensure that high-quality, comprehensive home care services are provided to the elderly and people with disabilities. Measure 99 passed by a 63% to 37% margin. The system has stabilized the workforce, provided high-quality training opportunities, maintains a statewide registry of home care providers to which clients and their guardians can look when seeking quality support. It allows the workers to be covered by workers' compensation through SAFE, and because they've chosen to unionize the current population, they have a vehicle for collective bargaining, and for those who work enough hours, a path to health benefits for people who could never afford to buy them on their own. The Home Care Commission program, as it exists today, however, only applies to those working with seniors and individuals with physical disabilities. It does not apply to other state-funded home care personal support service programs. Those working with individuals with developmental disabilities, with those experiencing mental illness, or with medically fragile children. This is a big problem for these workers and, I believe, for their clients. As you know, in many cases, the workers are doing very difficult physical work, and many of them are just one step away from poverty themselves. Not having access to workers' compensation is a huge problem and a concern not only for them, but also for their clients and their clients' families. The clients and their personal support workers have very close relations. Often they are considered family. In many cases, they actually are family members, either close family or more distant relations. I believe that clients and their advocates would like to see the workers covered by workers' comp as soon as possible and to have access to quality training programs. As you may remember from our last meeting, there is dispute over whether or not these populations were intended to be covered in the ballot measure in the first place, when the ballot measure spoke of people with disabilities. We heard from James Taves at our last meeting that DHS did a review of the issue and concluded that they were correctly implementing the intent of the amendment by not covering these workers. Others dispute that interpretation with passion. And in giving us their determination, DHS did agree that the matter was not free of doubt. The purpose of this legislation is to move beyond this dispute to come up with a statutory change that will clarify the matter and clearly extend coverage to these other populations. You have before you, members, a table that shows the various state programs as they currently exist, including who's currently in the Home Care Commission program and those who would be brought in under this legislation. Specifically, the bill, 3618, to speak to the specifics of it, creates a framework for this inclusion. Under the bill, DHS would begin the process of collecting the names of the additional workers immediately upon passage of the bill, with a deadline for doing so of next October 2010. The workers would come under the Home Care Commission then next January 1st of 2011. Workers' compensation coverage would begin at that time. They would become eligible for the Commission training programs on January 1st, and the Commission would begin developing and rolling out training sessions designed for the new populations. The Commission will also begin working on including these workers in the registry, the home care registry, and this work would be completed by 2013. The purpose of today's hearing is to focus on the policy aspects of the bill. We don't have cost estimates of the bill at this time, but we certainly will before the bill comes before you in a work session. I'll just say that workers' compensation premiums would apply to the final 6 months of the current biennium, and there will be some startup costs, including information technology costs. It's, of course, our goal to keep these biennial costs down as low as possible. As you can imagine, colleagues, working on this bill has been quite the process. In its earlier life as Senate Bill 702, it went through a number of drafts, 13 to be exact, in an effort to make sure that we were getting the definitions right in a way that correctly spoke to the duties performed by these additional workers, creating a list extending their duties, but it extends the existing activities of daily living list to include what we're calling activities of community inclusion, which really speaks to a lot of the work being done by these workers. At the end of the last session, many client advocates still had legitimate concerns about the impact of the legislation on the current system, a system that they respect and value. We are working with them and with DHS and the Home Care Commission on amendments that do address those concerns. I believe that there is a lot of goodwill around this issue, and we are making good progress on that. I want to be clear that it is not the intent of this legislation to limit the resources and choices of individuals experiencing developmental disabilities or mental illness, or their families, to purchase supports and services, or reduce the amount or scope of those supports and services. Nor is it to compromise the services being received by those in the population already under the Home Care Commission. There is consensus, I believe, among the stakeholders that we want to maintain the integrity of both systems in bringing them together. We are actively working with stakeholders, as I mentioned, to make sure that the final language of the bill reflects this intent. And I just learned this is kind of a moving target. I just learned that there's a group that we had not consulted, people in the Independent Choices Program, and I promised that this was inadvertent and that they will be brought into the conversation and we'll make sure that they are helped by this process, not hurt. Our goal, as we continue to finalize amendments with the stakeholders, is to return to you in February with a bill that maintains the integrity of the brokerage system, protects the principle of client self-determination, enhances the quality and stability of the home care personal support workforce, creates better communication, improves the lives of individuals experiencing developmental disabilities or mental illness, and their families, and the workers who support them. And now I'm going to turn to Bob Jundeff of Disability Rights Oregon, who will give you an overview of the amendment concepts that we're working on. And I'm very grateful to Bob for his help with this. We'll then have a panel of Margaret Tyson from the DD Coalition, together with Beverly Mackey from SEIU, followed by James Taves from DHS and Cheryl Miller from the Home Care Commission.
And thank you,
I thank you for your patience.
Thank you. And colleagues, this is just the first of public hearings we will be having. There will be amendments. The bill will be somewhat changed. We're not going to be able to take a whole lot of time today. I'm going to ask people to speak for 3 minutes. We will have a timekeeper here because we have 6 people who have signed up to speak. We have a big audience here. We have the overflow room in room C. Is that correct? So this is a very important issue. It's not going to be the last time we're going to be hearing. We'll be hearing a lot more on this issue in February. This is just going to be the first of hearings. So as I said, we will limit the testimony to 3 minutes per speaker. And what I'd like, if you don't mind, it would be if you'd hold your questions until the end, or even better yet, hold them for the next hearing or for the interim between our hearings, because we do have a full agenda and we have a lot of people here to testify. So thank you. Thank you, Representative.
Okay, Bob.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I'm here to present the conceptual amendments that we have come up with in our work with Representative Dembrow and Representative Kotek. And I want to take this opportunity to thank particularly Representative Dembrow, but also Representative Kotek for the good work they're doing in moving this forward. The task that we have before us is really one that we face because of the way the services are set up in the state. Services for people with developmental disabilities, services for people for mental illness operate completely differently than the way the senior and disabled services do. The infrastructure is different. Some of the methodology is different. And as an advocate for all of these groups, I can tell you that each group has fought for the services that they have, that all of these services are under-resourced, and so every group is highly sensitive to the risk of losing services or having a service system, particularly this service system, which is client-directed, ill-affected by any changes that we may make in good faith trying to help workers, but to have unintended consequences that might in fact hurt the client or the ability of the client to direct their own services and make decisions for themselves. And Margaret Tyson is going to talk about some of the history within 3 minutes that underlies this. But I can tell you, because I worked with these groups and I'm a member of the DD Coalition, worked for over 20 years, that these are hard-fought, dearly held services and rights. And so that's why we have worked so hard to get over some misunderstandings to get to where we can have an agreement. So the amendments do a few things. One is that it creates a special advisory group within the Home Care Commission that is made up of people who understand the service system. We're all working hard to understand these systems. They are complex. We need a group of people who really do understand what the service system is, that represent interests of all the parties, and can make recommendations to the Home Care Commission. These amendments would do that. Both in that group would reflect folks with developmental disabilities and mental illness. The Independent Choices group actually falls within the same what I would call bailiwick of people who have fought to get these services. They're marginally funded could be critically affected here. So we need to make sure that those interests are also covered. part of the provisions would require that the commission either follow recommendations that the committee came up with or say why not. And that's just an idea to keep this an open process, to make sure that new groups that are coming in know that they're being heard and know why decisions are being made. It's very simple. There's also some provisions that talk about legislative intent, and Representative Dembro touched on those that are so important, that it is not the intent of the legislature to cut back on services, resources.
Sorry,
and
Bob.
Finally.
That's my red light is.
Flashing light.
And finally, there's some definitions to make it clear what we're talking about in this area, and thank you very much.
And Bob, I think you've given us some written material. We will look at that, right.
Thank you.
And I'm sure people are going to be coming up with questions, and we're going to be addressing those to the two of you and other people who speak, and we're going to expect that those will be answered between now and our next hearing in February. Thank you so much. So now we have, whom else, who do you want first?
Margaret.
Margaret and Beverly?
Beverly.
Okay. And then James and Cheryl Miller, right? And then who is that last person who signed up? Ruth McEwen? Is Ruth McEwen here?
She's on the phone.
Okay, great, Ruth. We'll have you last but not least. Thank you. Go ahead.
Okay. Do you want to go? Okay. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Beverly Mackey, and I'm an elected director of SEIU's Local 503's Home Care Council. And I served this last year as the chair of the bargaining committee as well. I've been a home care provider for 5 years, and a little bit about my own background is that I became a home care provider to take care of a daughter who was in dialysis and very ill, not really expected to make it to a transplant. And the good news is I lost that client because she got a successful transplant and is on being a college student now at 40.
Yeah,
so
great.
I'm thrilled with that, and I just made a conscious decision that I wanted to continue doing home care because I realized what it gave was the chance for people to continue to make decisions about their lives in their homes, in where they're most comfortable. And sometimes those decisions are the last ones that they get to make independently. So it was really a wonderful thing that I came to understand what their needs were. I'm here to testify in support of the legislative concept 179 on behalf of the members of SEIUs and particularly home care providers. I know that the work I do and the work that thousands of home care providers affected by this legislation do is important work. We make it possible for people with disabilities to continue to live independently. After the 2000, when Oregonians voted to amend the state constitution and create the Home Care Commission, they are responsible for ensuring quality home care and services that are funded by the Department of Human Services for seniors and people with disabilities. That responsibility includes defining the qualifications for home care workers. We go through a criminal background check and checks to make sure that we're qualified and capable of taking care of someone. To create a statewide registry for home care workers, a valid, reasonable way to get work, and to provide training opportunities for home care workers and consumers. We constantly get better and better as home care workers, and I think that we're some of the best trained in the country because the Home Care Commission gives us training that's very standardized. You can move from client to client, and they sort of expect the same training, and they know that we'll provide that standardization of care. And to serve as the employer of record for purposes of collective bargaining for home care workers whose pay comes from public funds. Through the Home Care Commission, thousands of care providers have received training improving the quality of the care we provide, workers' compensation coverage, providing us protection on the job, and better wages and benefits through the collective bargaining. Health insurance was something that is very important to home care workers, and I can honestly tell you that it saved my life. After 2 years of being a home care worker, I suddenly came up with an aortic valve that didn't work anymore. And so I had to have surgery, and the results of that surgery is that it was successful. I'm still here. It was one of those types of things that the symptoms were sudden death. And so I was happy to get the surgery in time. The insurance paid for it. And as a home care worker, I never could have afforded $112,000 worth of insurance for this surgery. My out-of-pocket costs were $2,500. So just that's a personal example of something that I have seen as a direct result.
Your time is up, but you have five more words.
Okay. We are committed to working with advocates to ensure the appropriate representation and input of stakeholders in the work of the Home Care Commission and the creation of a developmental disability mental health advisory committee. We're also committed to ensuring that choice and self-determination remain essential rights of consumers.
Thank you so much. Listening. Thank you for coming today. And thank you for willing to stay within your 3 minutes. Go ahead.
Chairperson Tomei and members of the House Human Services Committee, thank you very much for the opportunity today to speak representing the developmental disabilities community. I'm Margaret Tyson. I'm the chair for the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition. I am also the executive director with Full Access, which is one of 12 support services brokerages in the state of Oregon. And I can attest after 6 years as the chair of the coalition and 8 years in my job, we have a very complicated system. And although this bill will complicate the system even further, if it delivers the benefits that are described in the amendments the coalition submitted, we definitely support this bill. Individuals choosing and directing their supports must be required. We have not opposed people getting access to workers' comp benefits and additional training, provided the assurance of maintaining the integrity of our services. The current bill appears it will address that given the amendments. As our brokerage directors have been gravely concerned, particularly about workers' comp issues, we just really want to acknowledge those that have opened the door to this opportunity for the individuals who work with our clients throughout the state. The complexity of our system is evidenced by the myriad of programs and funding streams, and is a result in part of the values that we hold. The values and specific systems set forth from Staley and infused in the other four DD services programs that are included in this bill are held dearly by our clients, families, advocates, and the broader DD community. As a group of citizens in our culture, people with developmental disabilities have largely been invisible. The evidence of this is poignantly clear by the rate of abuse they suffer and the lack of society's ability to stop abuse and convict the abusers. The role of families, allies, stakeholders, and advocates becomes all the more crucial because of this invisibility. The values we hold have been garnered through extremely difficult fights as our system transitioned from institutional care to community and home-based services. Thankfully, the last of our institutions has been closed, and remember, it was less than 10 years ago when then-Governor Kitzhaber formally apologized for the practice of our state of forced sterilization of individuals with developmental disabilities in our institutions. This and other parts of our history still haunt our clients and their families. I briefly reference this as an example of the horrifying abuses these populations experience and as the basis for the demands that people be given a voice and indeed direct through the self-directed services movement the supports they receive from the state. The complexity of the system is in response to the fact that we are talking about individualized supports, services that must respond from birth to death for a diverse population with very different needs. This bill overall impacts 7 programs under 6 Medicaid waivers and DD services alone. The funding and administrative structures are different and include nonprofit agencies, county and state government. The client funding ranges are from $500 a year to several thousand dollars a month, and a majority of the workers are family members. In some programs in geographic areas, the number of family members exceeds 60%. The fundamental common value in our system is that individuals and families know what is best in terms of the support that they need and the goods, services that they purchase. The inclusion of people with developmental disabilities and their families in meaningful participation in the design of services they rely on for their basic health and safety is a hallmark of our system.
Margaret, final words.
We appreciate the opportunity to speak to this bill and look forward to the implementation.
Thank you. You made some excellent points, and I think you've given us some written materials, too, and I appreciate that. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank now, you. We will hear from James. Is that Michael? James is next?
Yes, James and Cheryl.
Cheryl? Okay, yes. Great. And Ruth, could you sort of make your way up here, dear, so that you'll be next? Because they're only going to talk for 3 minutes each, so we're looking at 6 minutes here. Okay, James.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, James Tays from the Department of Human Services. I'm always here, so I'll take even less than 3 minutes and be available to come back. Margaret just mentioned some of the complexity that we've been working on in recent weeks to come up with overarching definitions of disability and expand the definitions of home care that we'll bring in, because literally we're dealing with 6 different programs, 5 different Medicaid waivers, 2 state plan options, so all with different payment mechanisms, different payment rates, different data requirements, different reporting systems. So the trick that we've been working on are what are those overarching definitions that will begin to blend all of those, and then how can we kind of in a high-touch, low-tech way cull the information into sources then that can produce the information needed. If we put this group under workers' comp, we begin counting hours towards health care or other kind of benefits. So those are the things we're working on right now. Our goal is obviously to be accurate, but to try to minimize the fiscal impact, but still be realistic given the rest of our budget situation for this biennium, and that's what we'll be working on with Representative Dembro and the stakeholders in the coming weeks before this bill is formally before you. Thank you.
Thank you, James. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Representative Tomei. Chair Tomei and committee members. My name is Cheryl Miller, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Home Care Commission. I think you've already heard of all the good work that the Commission does today. The Home Care Commission is an independent public commission, and what you haven't heard about is our history of working with stakeholders and creating committees or ad hoc committees or advisory groups to have input in the process. And that's something that we've successfully done over the years. That's how we developed our training program. That's how we developed our registry. And without the input of those stakeholders, we wouldn't be where we are today. I say all that to say also that our commissioners have expressed some concerns to me. As you know, we are living in very difficult economic times. And so just as you've heard from the other side, the other consumers, they're concerned about reductions in services and funding of some of the tasks that will be required to bring in the new groups. I think that's just a challenge that we all face. I think we can work through these challenges, but I did want you to hear the concerns of some of the consumers that I've heard from. I'll keep it short since you gave us 3 minutes.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Go ahead.
Chair Tomei, committee members.
We're holding you to 3 minutes too, dear.
Yes. My name is Ruth McEwen. I'm here representing the Oregon Disabilities Commission. We have 3 main issues. One, when Senate Bill 702 was considered in the 09 session, it was widely acknowledged the process to develop such didn't include many of the stakeholders and that no one could list all the disability populations nor the various programs and services it would impact. So the direction of the legislature was to the Department of Human Services to research the purview under the Home Care Commission to determine which personal service workers that work in the home and are paid with funds through the department fall under the Home Care Commission. Then a work group of Department of Human Services staff, key legislators, and stakeholders was to be formed to review the findings and determine if common language could be developed which would accomplish the goal of the bill. And second, because this work group was never formed to review the findings of the Department of Human Services, consider the opinions of the Attorney General nor work in common language that could assure no harm situation, the basis on which House Bill 3618 was written is flawed, and it should not be considered in this special session. No greater clarity exists now on the populations and programs that will be impacted than existed on Senate Bill 702. The Department of Human Services response to the budget note attached to Senate Bill 5529 states that the relevant language in both the Constitution and applicable statutes is often confusing and contradictory. It recommended that to resolve these issues, they must work with key legislators, the union stakeholders, to clarify, identify the workers, populations, and services that should be covered under the Home Care Commission. This is a process that must occur with deliberation, thoroughness, and include those identified as vital to comprehensive outcomes before any changes are made. This cannot happen in time for consideration of this bill during the February session, and if action is taken without such a response, the results will be seen by many as unsound due to the flawed foundation on which they were made.
Thank you for your testimony, Ruth. Thank you very much. And I'm assuming you're going to be in touch with Representative Dunbrough's office, or maybe you have been already.
We have not been contacted in any way.
Yes. Well, Madam Chair, let me say that, you know, we certainly will, and I really would like you to come to our next meeting, Ruth, or you or someone that you would recommend.
Okay.
Thank you.
Colleagues, we don't have a lot of time today for discussion, but if you have any questions, probably we wouldn't be able to answer them here, but you could bring them up here, or you can bring them up privately with Representative Dunbrough. But if you have anything here right now that you want to have discussed in a future meeting, I would be delighted to hear those concerns. Representative Maurer.
Chair, and it really has to do with if this were to pass, is the actual implementation within DHS, and because and you touched on it briefly, is the multiple systems don't talk. And that is, I mean, from a practical standpoint, is huge. It's one area. The other area is, and you can't address this, is how is SAFE going to handle issues where you have family members who make claims against other family members, and how do they distinguish between what is work and what's parenting or family responsibility? And those, I mean, you get into, that's real ripe for fraud, and it better be really clearly spelled out for protection of both the client and the injured party.
And these are exactly the kinds of questions that we need to hear right now and have answered in the future.
Yes, and we are addressing those.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Representative, for all the work. I know it's a very difficult issue. Thank you for all showing up today. I see so many familiar faces, and I'm so glad that you've come. Hi, Laddie. Yes, I haven't seen Laddie for a long time. So all of you, thank you for coming. Thanks you for all the work that you do. I know it's hard to get down here, but we really appreciate you showing up. And if you have any further questions, we want to have them answered. So thanks for all the work everybody has done, and thank you for coming today. Yeah, great. Okay, we're going to be closing the public hearing on House Bill 3618. Thank you very much. And we're going to open up the public hearing on House Bill 3625. We've got Wendy Davis, Phila Andor, and Catherine Bradley. Okay, ladies, start right up.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, Tomei, what if you need the bill? Oh, the committee.
So you are catching me off guard.
I know, I am.
All right, on my toes. Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this House Bill 3625 was introduced at the request, sponsored by Representative Carolyn Tomei. It designates May of each year as Maternal Mental Health Awareness Month, and it declares an emergency effective on passage.
Welcome.
Hello. Rep. Tomei and members of the committee. I'm Wendy Davis from Portland. I'm so glad to be in front of you again. And I am here to support passage of the bill to declare May of every year as Maternal Mental Health Awareness Month in Oregon. I'm a psychotherapist, like mental health consultant, a national educator specializing in maternal mental health. I've been a volunteer, an advocate, a mental health provider, and a survivor, always, of postpartum depression and anxiety. I know personally and professionally how important it is for every community to have accessible and competent and culturally competent care for all families to deal with maternal mental illness. I thought I want to take this opportunity to thank Rep. Tomei and Debbie Runciman for their ongoing support and encouragement for us to keep going on these bills for maternal mental health, pregnancy and postpartum mood and anxiety disorders. And I appreciate so much the time that this committee took last year before passage of the Maternal Mental Health Task Force bill to ask very thoughtful questions and to hear the answers. I thought you might like to hear some Oregon stats today to represent how important it is here to have a Maternal Mental Health Awareness Month. In the latest statistics that we have 15.8% of the pregnant women interviewed, this is over 2,000 women through the Department of Health, 15.8% said they had significant depression or anxiety during pregnancy, 10.8% postpartum, and a total, when asked, during pregnancy or postpartum, of 20.4%. Now, what that means, and I must admit, after 15 years of doing this work, it was only today I realized this. So if one out of every five women, mothers, is affected by significant and serious psychiatric mental health issues during pregnancy or postpartum, one out of every five in Oregon, more than one out of every five children is. Because every mother either has, you know, one child, multiples, twins, triplets, or older children. So this is a significant public health issue. What this means to me to have a bill where a month every year is designated is that we have a public awareness. We know that any crisis can only be prevented by a combination of awareness, resources, and pathways between the two. No matter what kind of systems we have, what kind of medications, what kind of therapy and social support, none of those works if parents are too ashamed to reach out for help. If you have an awareness month, we're saying we care about you. This is an issue. We know it exists. And we have legislative support to say this is important to us. So for me, well, when I got dressed this morning, I put on bright green because I needed the sense of spring. I needed spring today. And that's what that means to me, the hope that things do get better. That when my, and also you can't miss it, you know, we want awareness. When I was going through postpartum depression, anxiety, and I really honestly didn't know if I would make it, I was already a psychotherapist for 14 years. I knew nothing. Where's the awareness? I was from a large family. My mother had five children. And I really didn't know if I would survive. And my mother first said, you don't have postpartum depression. That's not what that is. Where's the awareness? By the end of my bringing awareness to my own family, one day I got in the mail a package of bulbs from my mom who said, plant them. Plant them now. Plant them in the winter because they grow in the spring. Sorry. And so that's what this is to me, is to say, you're not alone. We're with you. And the state of Oregon is with you. We become, by doing so, by being able to put every year permanently awareness cyclically to come back and remind us to focus our efforts, our education, and our messages for families so they don't have to, we can prevent a crisis if they'll reach out. But thank you so much. I thank you for your support. And I'm really, really excited to be here and help this move forward.
Thank you, Wendy, and thank you for all the work you've done on this issue for a long time. Thank you so much. Okay. Who's next?
I don't know. Let's watch.
You don't have to put your mouth right on it.
No. Representative Tomei and the committee, thank you very much for hearing us today. For the record, I'm Sheila Andor. I'm the executive director of a small nonprofit agency, Well Mama, where we provide social support and counseling to pregnant and postpartum women, mostly to those who suffer from perinatal anxiety or depression. I'm also co-coordinator with Wendy Davis of Postpartum Support International, where we do the same work on a volunteer basis. I am also a survivor of perinatal depression and anxiety, and a clinician myself with a social work background. And I was also here, and thank you very much for working with us all this time on the other bills as well. Just in terms of awareness, I would like to give you two examples how there is no awareness out there and how much this bill is necessary. Recently, I spoke with somebody at an agency where they serve postpartum women, and I was trying to get our flyers in, and I was told, oh, this is not a problem. We don't see these moms here. I don't think we really need your flyers. And you just heard the statistics from Wendy. And depending on how depression is defined, actually, the statistics can be extremely high. Another example, I just recently had a fundraiser in Corvallis, where I live, and I had several family members who actually came into town to help me with the fundraiser for my nonprofit, and my father-in-law and my brother-in-law, who witnessed my whole postpartum struggle that I went through, came up to me afterwards, and now my son is 6 years old, so this has been a while, but they came up to me and said, gee, we never knew. They did. Everybody was around me. I was suicidal. They knew that very well. And they knew our struggles. But the awareness just... And so this is so important. Thank you very much for listening to us.
Thank you. And thinking of that story of the agency you went to where they said, oh, we don't have that problem. So you couldn't imagine a woman who is feeling depression that she would come to them and say she's got it. It's like, you are too weird. You're off the charts. It's just no acknowledgement that this does happen. Thank you. Catherine.
For the record, my name is Catherine Bradley, and I'm the administrator for the Office of Family Health in the Public Health Division. We're here today just to provide a little bit of brief information to this committee in thanks for the bill that was passed last session, House Bill 2666. And what you have in front of you is the committee. I just wanted to share with you the committee work has started. We do have a committee that has been appointed under the direction of Dr. Bruce Goldberg. It does reflect the requests in the bill of a diversity of providers, clinicians, people who have experienced postpartum depression as well as different parts of the states and rural and urban. I will tell you this was a huge challenge. We actually wanted to have a committee of 25 or 30 people, and the number of people who were interested in this were tremendous. But we boiled it down to a core group of 13, although we have many other participants who are interested in providing information. And what you'll find on the other side of your paper is the work group charge that comes out of the original legislation. And the way we are structuring this is we actually have two subcommittees that are working with a larger group that will be focusing on a variety of components out of the legislation. And we're on a pretty fast track. We had our first meeting about a week and a half ago, and we've got a schedule that will then have us reporting back in September with recommendations. And again, thank you very much to the committee.
We are so excited that you're already working with such a wonderful sounding group. That's terrific. I was just thinking, colleagues, we talked a lot, and Lou, I think you missed the conversation we had earlier about maternal mental health and how we sort of got to this point. But we know what the shame that goes with any kind of mental health problems of anyone, and the shame is multiplied by 1,000 times if you're a mother, a new mother, who is having depression. It's hard for anyone to admit or to acknowledge, even in the family. So thanks for all you're doing. Any questions of anyone on this panel?
I would just like to acknowledge that one of my good friends and constituents is on this group.
Good.
So, Joella Detman. So I'm very happy to see that. So I will probably know quite a bit about this all the time.
That's great. Good. Any other questions, concerns, comments? Thank you for all you're doing.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Okay, we're going, is anyone else who wants to testify on this? Nobody, I think, has signed up. Is there? Probably not. All right. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 3625 and open up the House hearing on House Bill 3631. And you want to read that, Sandy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3631 is sponsored by Representative Van Orman, prohibits insurers from treating injuries sustained from sexual violence as pre-existing condition from coverage, underwriting, or rating purposes. This, too, also has an emergency clause.
Representative Van Orman.
Yes, thank you.
Are you coming up?
Patty Kenyon?
Is Patty coming
up? Okay. Thank you.
Come on up. Yeah, we need another chance. Chair Tomei, Vice Chair Boone, and members of the committee, I am Suzanne Van Orman. I am representative of House District 52 for Hood River County, parts of Clackamas County, Mount Hood included, and parts of Multnomah County on the east of the Sandy River. I am here today to talk to you about House Bill 3631. My position as a member of the community in Hood River has been to participate with the Seroptimus Group. And the Seroptimus International Group is very involved in trafficking, but our local group is very involved in domestic violence. It's one of the key issues. We raise a significant amount of money to support our Helping Hands organization, which provides care for victims of domestic violence. We have become aware, of course, that there are states that have determined that victims of sexual violence or domestic assault or domestic violence may be prohibited from health care because it's a pre-existing condition. So the purpose of this legislation is to prevent this happening to this vulnerable group in Oregon. We know we have statutes that relate to protecting victims of domestic violence, but this bill will strengthen our current law as well as expand our law to cover sexual assault or sexual violence. One example would be that the current law does not protect the coverage of mental health injuries caused by rape and other forms of sexual violence. And I think one of the most important policy considerations for us is that discrimination against these victims will only further discourage them from coming forward to law enforcement and seeking medical help. And I think in many ways I relate it to those of us who have car insurance. And when we have a ding in our car, we might fix it ourselves as opposed to reporting it to our insurance company so that we don't get an increase in our cost or we get dropped from that particular insurance company. So this is a preemptive move to protect a very vulnerable population. And I have with me the experts in the field to speak to you on that.
Thank you, Representative.
If I might, Chair Tomei, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center, and I'd like to go next because we decided that I would try to provide a little bit of national context for this issue, and then Christine and Stacey will talk more specifically about the sexual assault issues. And I appreciate the committee's attention to this issue and Rep. Van Orman's leadership here on this bill. The bill, as it's proposed, would provide an expansion to ORS 746.015, where our current protections for against discrimination on the basis of a person's status as a victim of domestic violence are currently codified. The bill would do two things. It would expand the current protection, and it maintains the current structure of the current protection, but it would expand that protection to make sure that it also includes protection for victims of sexual violence. And in another respect, it would clarify the current protection to make sure that it covers also treatment for injuries sustained as a result of the violence. So it would make two changes. One is add sexual violence victims to the protection, and the other is clarify that the discrimination covers the treatment issues for mental and physical injuries. And just nationally, I think the reason that this issue has been important is exactly as Representative Van Wormen stated, we want to make sure that we have a message sent out to survivors in this state that they ought not to fear that their coming forward to seek treatment will result in a further denial of their coverage for health care. Just to give a little bit of historical structure, in the 1990s, we understood through both state and federal studies that across the board there was widespread discrimination against victims of domestic violence. It was being used as a criterion in underrating policies. It was being used as a means to deny or reduce coverage or to make it more expensive, and it was inappropriate. And nationally, states took steps to resolve that. 42 states, including Oregon, have protection, as is codified in Oregon law, that prohibit such discrimination on the basis of a person's status as a victim of domestic violence. And that's made a difference. And what we're hoping to do now is to make that same difference for victims of sexual assault. We have seen nationally that there are some examples of victims of sexual assault being denied coverage. I think it's happened a lot more as a result of hospitals becoming more aware and states becoming more aware of the problem of sexual violence, and rape forensic exams are now provided at hospitals. HIV prophylaxis is, thank heavens, available to survivors. And those two things, I think, have resulted nationally. And we don't have examples in Oregon of this being a problem. So I want to be very clear that we're not saying that Oregon business providers are bad actors or doing bad things. What we're concerned about is the nationwide examples having an impact on the survivor population. And we realized in looking at our statute that we have a hole in our protection coverage. And it's important to fill that hole so that we send the message to survivors, you don't have to be afraid. You can get your rape exam at the hospital, and it's not going to result in future discrimination for the life of your insurance policy. And that's an important message, of course, for public policy, public safety, and justice reasons. So that's why we appreciate the attention. As I said, 42 states already have this protection. The bill, as it's proposed, will be in keeping with the model laws that are endorsed by the National Women's Law Center, as well as the Family Violence Prevention Fund, and the National Network to End Domestic Violence. I forgot my third. As well, the National Association of Insurance Commissioners has a national a model law, which contains some of these same principles. So we looked at that background in devising this solution. And we do think that it will be helpful in sending the right message to survivors in this state and to our communities. The only other thing that I would mention is that the current structure of the law does contain protections for industry. Good faith compliance is an absolute bar to civil liability. The remedy if the Department of Consumer and Business Services gets complaints is that administrative agency can make an investigation. If they determine that there is a willful violation, then they can move after an investigation, move forward with administrative sanctions. But this is not meant to be a punitive law. It's meant to send a message to our communities that we want to do the right thing, and it makes a big difference. So we appreciate your attention. And I included in my testimony a list of all of the other state statutes that contain similar protections, and I'm happy to talk further.
Thank you, Sybil.
Thank you. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, thank you. My name is Christine Herman. I'm the Executive Director of the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Task Force. We are a 501c3 nonprofit statewide organization that's dedicated to improving the response to and reducing the incidence of sexual assault. And I want to echo Sybil Hebb's thanks to Representative Van Wormen for bringing forward this legislation and giving Oregon the opportunity to get ahead of a potential problem. As has been noted, there is not, we aren't aware of any problems in Oregon. What we are aware of is that nationwide this is an issue that's gotten a lot of attention. And what we know is every little barrier that's put in place between a victim receiving services and getting services can be everything it takes to stop that service from happening. But we know that very few rapes are reported. Fewer rape victims are getting medical treatment as needed. And as Patty Kenyon, who's with me here today, will testify, I'm sure, sexual assault is a medical emergency. It is important that victims of sexual assault receive treatment immediately to reduce the impact of that crime on their future health and mental and physical health. And
So for that reason, it's important that we make it clear that we want people to feel free to come for service without any potential for some future, essentially punishment for being a victim of crime. So I want to thank you for your time and for hearing this bill. And again, thank you, Representative Van Orman, for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Christine.
Hi, Representative Tomei and the committee. I'm Patty Kenyon. I'm the SANE, or Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner, Technical Assistance or Coordinator for the Sexual Assault Task Force. I'm also a practicing SANE here in the Willamette Valley. Recent studies have shown that as high as 37% of all health care costs are the results of abuse. This includes, but is not limited to, mental health issues, disease processes as the result of addictive behaviors, addiction to nicotine, drugs, and alcohol, heart disease, hypertension, obesity, and infections. When infections are left untreated, they are allowed to spread to others. This can lead to infertility in women. The cost of medications for sexually transmitted infections is approximately $100. Far less than the cost of treating those who unknowingly may be exposed to the infection, or if the woman becomes infertile due to the scarring of her fallopian tubes. The cost of emergency contraception medication is $35 to $50 over the counter. The cost of an unplanned pregnancy is obviously much, much higher. None of us want these things to happen to those we love or to bear the cost of paying for these problems. One of the things that I hear when caring for victims is, I can't afford this visit to the emergency department, and does my insurance carrier have to know? Victims of abuse are often young, and they are very concerned that very few people know about it, as few as possible know about it. As news of the possibility of insurance carriers denying claims or of future carriers denying insurance for pre-existing conditions spreads, people are concerned about letting that carrier know, even know of the assault. While it is imperative that healthcare professionals realize the future implications of victimization so that proper care can be given at the time of the assault, it is also imperative that insurance companies realize that the victim is not at fault, rather, it is the assailant who is at fault. No one should be held financially responsible for the action of another. Our healthcare choices should not be limited because of another person's choice to victimize others. Ultimately, we are, as a society, will benefit if insurance companies pay for the immediate treatment after the assault rather than for caring for somebody throughout their lifetime. Thank you.
Thank you, Patty. Any questions of any of these presenters?
Madam Chair, how many people do we have?
This is it. Then
I do have just a couple questions.
Sure.
So domestic violence is already in the statute. We're adding a new term, sexual violence. And the difference, I mean, I see the difference. And we don't have a problem in Oregon. All the insurance carriers, I'm assuming, have been, at least are aware of this. Do we know that?
I believe they are.
Chair Tomei and Representative Maurer, I think, you know, given the time frames of the current session, I'm sure many people are still trying to read and assess. The bill is publicly available now, and we'll do our best to talk to as many people as we can.
And, well, it just, I mean, one of the issues, because sitting on healthcare, you hear this all the time, is that the insurance companies, if they want to, are really good at parsing the language and getting out. So to me, it obviously, but on the other hand, in a lot of these issues, they're very, I mean, it's very clear that they aren't attempting to parse the language. So it appears that they're not trying to do that today, that they're probably rolling sexual violence into domestic violence maybe already. I guess I'm supportive of this, and I have absolutely no problem with it, but I just think that is really, I want to make sure that there's not some underlying little devil that's going to come up and bite this one.
And if I may, Rep. Tomei, thank you. I can't see down my left. and Representative Maurer, I appreciate the question. I think we always hope there's not some little devil that comes up, none that I'm aware of. Certainly we'll continue to talk to people and try to do our best to have those conversations. I do think that to me and to advocates that with whom I've spoken, I think the most important, maybe single most important thing here that we can be doing as a committee, or that you can be doing as a committee, is to send the public policy message that it is okay to come forward. And as I don't think anyone's purposely out there trying to close those doors, but the perception of a closed door is just as damaging. So,
and we will make sure the insurance companies see this so that nobody's taken by surprise. Thank you.
I think they are.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, and I'll make this brief. And very supportive of the concept. Seems like we're already doing it, but if we need to make it clearer, that's great. My question is more around the fact that we've got an emergency clause in the bill to take effect immediately during emergency session. Seems like that's two emergencies for something that's not already happening. I just wondered if anybody would like to elaborate on why it's the urgency.
Well, I don't think I have an answer for that. I think it's just something that we feel that we, that why postpone it? Just let's put it into action now. Why wait?
And if I may, Rep. Tomei and Representative Freeman, I actually do think there was quite a bit of national attention on the denial of rape victims coverage and discrimination against rape victims. Again, we don't have examples here, but there was so much national attention that I worry a little bit that the message got communicated that that might be a problem to victims in the community, and we want to do the best thing we can as quickly as possible to say that's not the case here. So to me, I think urgency is related to that.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions, concerns, comments?
If I might just sum up, I think one of the things that, for me, caused me to move is that I remember when I was a director of that other program, which I promise not to even mention anymore, we were told that we had to have a monitor on the bus, and then every kid had to have these special harnesses. The cost effect for my program was $80,000, and I got no new money. So a lot of programs throughout the nation fussed, and the Head Start Bureau said, well, we'll give you a waiver. And I said, you know, why give me a waiver? You have already alerted me that this is a possible liability for me, and if I don't do it, I am negligent. And I felt that this is one of those times that I am aware of this, and for me not to at least step forward, am I in fact negligent?
Good point. Thank you, Representative. Okay, with that, thank you very much for reading this bill to us. And if, unless there's somebody else who wants to speak on this bill, I'm going to be closing the public hearing on House Bill 3631 and opening up a public hearing. We'll be hearing committee bills now. And I know some people have to leave in an hour, so we're going to try to get through these in that time if we can. So we're going to be opening up a public hearing on legislative concept 161, which is relating to persons subject to regulation by the Oregon Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists. Hello, welcome. Hi there.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Good afternoon, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Becky Eklund. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Board of Counselors and Therapists, and I'm here to talk to you in support of legislative concept 161. And I think this proposal is here to address an unintended consequence of legislation that was passed during the 2009 session. One of the provisions in House Bill 2506 was that licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists who are licensed as of January 1st of this year had to attest that they had diagnosis, training, and experience. If they were unable to attest to that diagnosis, training, and experience, they, by January 1st, a couple weeks ago, they are unable to practice. There's a clause in the legislation that sunsets that language in 2012.
So there was some confusion about the timing of those two provisions. So the bill passed in June of last year. We had basically 6 months to set procedures in place, communicate with the over 2,000 licensees to let them know they had to attest before January 1st or they were unable to practice. We were hoping that we weren't going to put anybody out of work or take licenses away from people who are well-qualified, highly experienced at a time when we need them in the workplace providing services. Because we were kind of searching for ways to make this workable and not put take licenses away, we consulted our Assistant Attorney General to take a look at the timing, to take a look at the responsibilities for the board. And the advice we received was that, in fact, January 1st of 2010 was the date. And if people could not attest, the board had a legal obligation to impose suspensions on those licensees who had not attested. If their licenses are suspended, that constitutes official discipline that is then reported to a national data bank and shows up as discipline on their licenses, which then affects their jobs, affects whether they will get clients, and affects whether they can be reimbursed for their services. So I'm hoping that you will move this very simple amendment forward with one little date change in there so that people can keep their jobs, keep working. We sent the attestation forms. We did a one-page check-the-box form to 2,079 licensees on October 1st. As of today, we've received 88% of those back. But we still have over 200 licensees who did not respond to that. 90 of those are not practicing, and we're in the process of following up with the others to find out, did they attest because they forgot, or did they not get the information, or are they not able to attest? But we would like to address this problem and think that this changing of the date will allow more time for licensees to attest and provide the documentation showing that they have the appropriate training and experience.
This was one of those unintended consequences that Representative Maurer was referring to earlier, and so I think this corrects that, hopefully.
Thank you.
Okay, do you want to make your presentation, then we'll take questions.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Larry Connor. I'm a licensed professional counselor from Portland, and I'm appearing as the co-director of the Oregon Coalition for Consumer Mental Health Protection and Choice, the group that sponsored the bill last year. I'm one of the authors of the bill, and I'm here to say I'm sorry. I'm sorry that we have to bother you with this in the midst of you dealing with important issues. There's some written testimony, so I'm not going to go. Becky's just summed up the situation. I would say this. We negotiated the attestation language with the Oregon Psychological Association. When we wrote it with the help of the Office of Legislative Counsel, because that whole section sunsetted, as Becky mentioned, in 2012, we assumed that all licensees would have 2 years to upgrade their skills if they didn't have the skills as right now. What we found out was that, in fact, that was not the way it was going to be interpreted. So the board has done a wonderful job trying to get all current licensees through the attestation process, and there are those few remaining who are not able to attest. What I can say to you is the language of Legislative Concept 161 is what we intended it to say when we wrote it. We just didn't realize that we were walking into a bit of a trap there. Or let's say a hole. We were walking into a hole. So it does not, this Legislative Concept 161 does not change any content in the Practice Act. It just changes the date for attestation. For us, it is a fairness issue that there were licensees who have been working for years under that came in under the old system. We changed the rules. We elevated the LPC and LMFT to clinical practice licenses with diagnosis and treatment of mental disorders as an essential part of that. I shouldn't say we elevated. What we did is we made language that had been implied explicit. And for those people who did not qualify under the new rules, we feel it's a fairness issue to give them the 2 years that we intended so that they can get their skills up and be able to keep their licenses. So I just want to thank you, apologize, and thank you for your ongoing support for providers of mental health services and consumers of mental health services. Thank you.
This original bill took a great deal of effort on the part of many people in different professions. So it really was a wonderful bill, and it's one small problem, I think, that we can easily correct. So any questions of either of these folks?
I have one question.
Yes, Representative Imbro.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. Have you heard from anyone that wants to be able to attest, you know, that wants to make the changes necessary to comply, but just this is such an impossibly short time period, which it is remarkably short?
Chair Tomei, Representative Dembro, we have heard from licensees in that very situation. There are a number of school counselors or counselor educators who have some. Everybody has the training. They all have master's degrees. They all took diagnosis training, and most of them have followed up with continuing education to strengthen their training. Some of them, when they were in internships working toward licensure, had diagnosis experience, and they can count that. But school counselors rarely diagnose the children that they see, and counselor educators are in a similar situation where they need some more time to get that kind of experience to be able to attest.
Thank you.
Any further questions?
May I add just something? We've had half a dozen or so people resign their licenses because they want to be honest about attesting. They've had the training, but they haven't had the experience. They feel terrible. They want to keep their licenses. They're very proud of it, but don't see a way, unless they find a new job, to be able to meet that attestation. So it's sad to see them give that license up after they've worked so hard and been so proud of it for so many years.
Okay, any further? Thank you very much for coming
Thank
today
you.
And helping us correct this unintended mistake. Okay, we will close the public hearing on Legislative Concept 161 and open up a public hearing on Legislative Concept 164. So we have Cindy Becker, Martin Taylor, Patty O'Sullivan,
Judy Moore Peterson,
and somebody from Senator Mona Sanderson's office.
Matt.
Hi, Matt.
It's not Patty, it's Judy Moore.
Judy. Hi, Judy. Hello. You want Matt to go first?
Yes.
Matt, I think we're inviting you to go first.
That's okay.
Hello. My name is Matt Anderson. I'm assistant to Senator Mona Sanderson, and I'm speaking about LC 164, information sharing in the area of mental and physical health records. Back in 2007, Department of Human Services introduced Senate Bill 163 related to the sharing of health records. It was meant to clarify what's okay to be shared under HIPAA and the ORS. However, it only confused the issue more. So Senate Bill 163 has some limitations that prevent it from achieving what it wanted to. For example, there's no way of knowing which Oregon Health Plan members have signed an acknowledgement of releasing their information. The list of 10 disclosable items is too narrow for providers to work together effectively, which means that a practical matter, every patient really needs to have individual authorization signed before they integrate patient care plans. The third thing is designating and planning for integration of physical and mental health services at the local and regional level is not possible. And so if Senate Bill 163 is repealed, what the law will say about the exchange of private medical information between mental and physical health Medicaid management care plans, the HIPAA allows the exchange of the information. The ORS 192 allows the sharing of information, and ORS 179 gives protection covering sharing of clinically therapy notes. So 163 needs to be repealed, and if there's any questions, I can answer them.
Thank you, Matt. We're going to let everybody speak, and then we'll come back questions. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm here representing Care Oregon. It's good to see you all again, and at least one new face up here. Welcome. So in 2007, Care Oregon was among a group of fully capitated health plans that worked with the state to introduce legislation that was intended to help us do a better job of being able to do care management for complicated patients that had mental health and physical health needs. So they'd be working between a mental health Medicaid plan and a physical health Medicaid plan. We break them up in Oregon. The bill that was introduced got amended to have a series of checks and balances around our needs to be able to do better case management and a patient's needs to have their privacy protected. And at the end of that process, we had a bill that we thought was implementable, and to be honest, the application of those checks and balances has been a very big problem for some of the reasons that Matt just explained. We simply don't know who has and hasn't signed an acknowledgement form, and we aren't allowed to exchange information without having them sign an acknowledgement form. And it turns out to be very complicated to figure out how to do that. And then a second thing occurred, which is that we now have a big move towards integrating health services, and we need to exchange aggregate data to know where we have overlapping patients, what their conditions are, and where their providers are. And of course, none of that is possible when you don't know who's signed an acknowledgement form and who hasn't, and that's now the trigger for exchanging information. So we brought this problem to some legislators in the agency at the end of last session, found ourselves in a place where it was important to have a process between the end of session and now to try to address this problem. In that period of time, there have been a number of groups that have met, included the state, the counties, advocates for the patient populations, the mental health plans, and the physical health plans. We've also spent some time talking with Senator Monis Anderson and Chair Tomei and the members that worked most closely on this bill last session. And our conclusion is that the best approach is to simply repeal the law that we passed in 2007 and ask the Oregon Health Authority to incorporate a discussion on what the appropriate checks and balances in this area might be as they are moving forward with mental health integration proposals. There are folks next to me who are much more expert on the specific technical problems we have applying this law and exactly what we need to do in order to integrate services at the county level, and we can take as much or as little time as the committee desires to explain those specific things.
Oh, great. Thank you, Martin.
Thanks.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Cindy Becker, and I am the director of the Clackamas County Department of Health, Housing, and Human Services, and I'm really pleased to be here, and it's really nice to see all of you. So, before I took this job, I actually worked with the fully capitated health plans and the department on this bill in 2007, and we thought we had come up with this really great solution, because the reality is that we're talking about mutually shared clients. So one of the things I want to make sure people understand, we're not plans aren't asking for information about people that they don't both cover. But there are, you know, most if not all of our clients that we see in mental health are also covered by a fully capitated health plan. And there was a perception that we weren't able to share information. And so the motivation for the bill was to clarify that. And as you heard with the bill before you, the LC before you, there were unintended consequences. And that's exactly what happened here. As I work now for the county, and we actually operate a mental health organization, I also see it from that side. In order for our folks to get get the kind of care coordination that they need and desire, people who serve them need to be able to share information to be able to better help their clients. And what's happened with the bill is that we've run into roadblocks to the point that all parties have essentially shut down. And so there is less sharing of information than there was before our great idea to clarify information. So I really want to thank Senator Montes Anderson and Chair Tomei for understanding how important this is to the individuals that we serve, particularly with behavioral health and addictions issues. This is something that we had a big meeting of. It's not often that everybody at the table agrees, and we actually had that with the state and the counties and the mental health plans and the fully capitated health plans and folks representing clients. I mean, it was a joy to behold. And so I really appreciate you taking this as one of the committee bills. It's really important to the people we serve, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. Go
ahead. Good afternoon. My name is Judy Moore Peterson. I am the Assistant Director, and I head up the Division of Medical Assistance Programs with the Department of Human Services. And I'm speaking on behalf of the department. I'm in agreement with the former speakers that this has proven to be much more difficult, technically difficult to implement than what we had envisioned when the bill was passed. And I just wanted to speak a little bit about some of those technical difficulties. We outlined a very nice working plan and of, you know, how we would need to change our application, then once we changed the application, then it would, you know, come back to us with the signed acknowledgement, and then we realized, well, what if someone doesn't sign it and doesn't want to sign it? Then we need to be able to track that, and then how we're going to be able to keep the acknowledgement with each of the people who are on the application, because as a family fills out an application, it's not just for one person; it's for the entire family, and so we needed a separate acknowledgement for each member of the family, and then needed to be able to coordinate all those things. Well, that's kind of on the paperwork side. On the tracking side, we also need to make some system changes to be able to then track who has received one of those new applications, who has signed it, and keeping all that together. Making systems changes with the Medicaid Management Information System, our new MMIS, which was not in place at that particular time, was challenging, and making changes to also our it's called our client maintenance system, which handles the children, deaths, and families applications. Even after all of that, then we realized that not everybody fills out a new application, that we were going to have to do a mailing to all the other folks. They're primarily seniors or within the disabled community who, to reduce paperwork, don't need to fill out a new application every single, you know, once a year. And so we were going to need to do a separate mailing for that. And again, I don't know about you, but, you know, I don't return everything that's sent to me asking for a signature. And so we knew that it was going to be, essentially impossible to get a signed acknowledgement from everyone, at least on our programs. Then the managed care plans themselves faced similar issues because they were also a covered entity. They were also able to obtain those signed acknowledgments. So it's been much more of a logistical
nightmare.
Nightmare, thank you. I was trying to avoid that word, but it's been much more difficult to implement than what we had originally envisioned, and we support repealing this. We're on board with that as well.
Great. Any questions of any of these presenters? So I'm glad that we're going to be correcting another unintended consequence. So good job. Thank you very much.
Well, at least we tried.
Yes, we tried. Does anyone else wish to testify on LC? With that, we will close the public hearing on Legislative Concept 164 and open up a public hearing on Legislative Concept 162. Why don't you read that?
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, LC 162 requires the state fire marshal to inspect and report on safety of child care facilities located on school premises as part of the child care facility certification, registration, and renewal processes. It provides the fire marshal with rulemaking authority, and this too has an emergency clause effective on passage.
Welcome, Reagan.
Hi, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Reagan Gray. I'm the policy director for Children First for Oregon. And I came to the committee and asked for this legislation to be introduced because I've been hearing from child care providers who are frustrated working in the schools, and sometimes they were being asked to request a separate fire marshal or fire inspection of the school for the purposes of child care, even though the school has been deemed safe for operating for school use. So we had this legislation drafted, which is intended to make it so that one inspection satisfies the needs for the school use as well as the child care division's needs for the licensure of that provider to operate within the school. When we got the draft back, it was much larger than what we had expected and definitely needed a lot of tinkering with and amendments. We had a little meeting with representatives from the Fire Marshal's Department and the Child Care Division out in the hall, talking about what could be changed to that draft. And actually, what we realized is that procedurally, we could come up with a way to deal with this issue without having to pass legislation. So I guess I'm kind of saying I'm withdrawing my request.
Good news for me.
Yeah, that's great. For the committee. I think what we're going to be able to do is have a supplemental information from the Fire Marshals Association and the State Fire Marshal's Office designating what is appropriate use of a school building for child care.
Great. Any questions of this person? Okay, and thank you so much for coming, and you're welcome to come up and speak, but it sounds like you've taken care of it and you don't need us to do anything. Is that correct? Thank you for coming, and thank you for agreeing to meet with, especially out here in the hall, and taking care of this. We love when we don't have to do new legislation.
Withdrawal and a repeal.
Representative Chair, but the force of the legislature did
brought the parties together.
Right.
That's true. Right. That's true. That's right. Right. Good job. Yes.
The force of the legislature did.
Yeah, that's great. Good. Thanks for making
so
that
we
point.
We do have value.
Well, you're happy. I know Representative Freeman's happy because we've had one repeal and one withdrawal.
That's right. That's right. Okay, with that, I will close, unless there's anything more. Close the public hearing on Legislative Concept 162. And Representative Dembro, you wanted to talk with us some about public guardianship task force report?
Yeah, Madam Chair, thank you. I don't necessarily need to talk about it, although I'd be happy to answer questions, but rather just to provide a little context. This was one of those cases where I woke up after the session ended and learned I'd been appointed to a task force about something I knew nothing about.
Oh, that's the meeting.
But it's been actually a very good experience. It has to do with, looking at the status of the way Oregon handles public guardians and conservators. Mm. You know, this is designed for people who don't have the means to have a paid guardian, or they don't have an estate that would go into that. And Multnomah County actually has a county agency that provides those services, but it's the only county that does. The others are done through a variety of ways, and there is desire within the guardian conservator private industry and the bar to come up with some state standards just to make sure that that there's not any inappropriate action happening, because as I think you probably know, instances of elder abuse and abuse of taking advantage of people with disabilities is on the increase in the given the current economy, and so it's a real concern. And this task force has brought together really a great group of people. You can see in this report just what's been done to date. We will, if time permits, in February, bring some people from the task force in for an information hearing on this subject, just to bring you up to speed. Together with the report is a list of the people on it, and it's really a great group of people. I do want to correct one thing, though, that it says that the chair, the Honorable Claudia Burton, was elected. The Honorable Claudia Burton was elected chair. It's actually Elizabeth Welch, Betsy Welch, who was elected chair. They're both judges. Betsy Welch is a retired judge, and she's a very able chair of this task force now.
She's former judge at Multnomah County?
Yes.
Married to Don Welch?
I don't know.
There are two Elizabeth Welches.
Right. There, you'll see the list of people who are at-large members, and she is one. Travis Wall used to be the state guardian in Utah. He brings a lot of national experience to it. And Patty Little is with Lane County Senior and Persons with Disabilities Services. So, again, a great group of people. You can see the agenda. You can see the schedule of meetings. We are scheduled to provide this committee with a report next October, and there's a website up, so I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about it. It's, again, just another step in my ongoing professional development as a human being, as this committee seems to be providing me with.
And we're proud of you.
Thank you for being willing to take this on and be an active member in this group. I think this is a very important one. I don't know if you remember when we had testimony about the state ombudsman, that 60% of the people who are getting ongoing care never get a visitor. That's why these kinds of programs are so important.
Madam Chair, and it's my goal for the February session that Representative Dembrough get assigned to at least three additional work groups or task forces.
For his own good.
For his own breadth and width of experience.
Right, and you're going to join him.
Do you need a second on that?
I do have a report. Wasn't it this our last hearing that we had Rick Krieger from Housing talking about 10-year community housing plans and whatnot? Homeless plans. And I actually did follow up on that. And this week, the Mid-Columbia is having our first 10-year organization plan. I don't know, Suzanne, did you know that?
Yes, I did.
You got the memo?
Yes. Okay.
So we're following through with that. And since then, also, we've dedicated a six-unit, not necessarily temporary housing, but along with community housing. And so things are progressing nicely.
Terrific. Good. Thank you. We've got two more possible projects, one in Cascade Locks and one in Hood River, big one in Hood River.
Good. Anything else for the good of the order? Thank you all so much, and I will see you February 1st, if not before. Ron,
you and I are on stage later. Are you doing that?
Oh, okay. We close the House Interim Committee on Human Services. Thank you.